Has it been a full week already? Yes, yes it has. Another week has passed, which means it's time for another delicious cocktail of the week on Thirst World Problems. Now, the cocktail we're going to be giving you is one that you've asked for. So I've had a request for yet another whiskey cocktail. I guess a lot of people have got some whiskey left in their shelves there. And because you asked for a whiskey cocktail, you're going to get a whiskey cocktail. Now, we've done a whiskey sour, classic cocktail, one that's near and dear to my heart, will always be up there for me. We've done a New York sour, which is a great variation on it. I've had a lot of fun with that. And right now, actually, I've been drinking those a fair bit. And if you keep your eye posted to some of the drink blogs, you'll notice that it seems to be going through a little bit of a resurgence. I've seen that Fawn Weaver, the CEO of Uncle Nearest Whiskey, has been making them as well and has been enjoying them. So I guess Thirst World's in some good company right there. And now this week I'm giving you the 8th Ward. The 8th Ward mixes citrus. So we're talking lemon, we're talking orange juice, a little bit of sweet with that grenadine. And then it's giving you a nice double pour of whiskey. So the full recipe you can find on thirstworldproblems.ca. You can also go to our IG page at Thirst World Problems, and you're going to see a nice little picture on there, and as well as the ingredients and how to put it together. Now, what makes this so much fun is because of the it's a neat little variation, almost on like a screwdriver. So you've come up, you've been drinking screwdrivers, classic highball, but now you get that little bit more of a refined taste. You know, you're a little bit older, you're not 18 anymore, or maybe you still are, and good for you. You should keep rocking those highballs. And you want something a little bit different, you want to class it up a little bit, you can try the 8th Ward. Like I said, you're going to be able to find the recipes on our site, and that should be good for you. Now, this episode, before we get into a dancing mode and we put on our dancing shoes, so this episode is going to be a little bit different this week. So what we're going to do is we're going to release part one of our interview with Kirsten Amon, who is a representative sales rep of Uncle Nearest Whiskey. We've had her on before to talk to us a little bit about the history behind Uncle Nearest. So you'll get a little bit of that. She has her own podcast, Drinking Like Ladies, where you can download wherever you listen to your podcast. And she's going to talk a little bit about that and give us a little bit more background on her personal history and how she got into the drink game. Coming at you back to back, rapid fire, no time to wait. You can digest them as quickly or as slowly as you want if you want to savor them. That's how we're giving them to you this week. Enjoy yourself. Remember, drink better, drink responsibly, and always feel the vibes.
Welcome to the Thirst World Problems Podcast, where we talk about drinks, current events, music, and more. Now, here's your host, Nick Dugal, and his panel of experts, B, Bell, and the infamous Doc.
This is Bell coming at you from behind the mic on Thirst World Problems, and today we are changing it up a little bit, doing something a little bit different, and we're going to be interviewing Kitty Amen, who is a nun at one of the local orphanages where they specialize in, looking for adoptions for the tiniest children the world has ever seen. Kitty, is that a
boy? Oh my God. That's really funny.
you've been hitting those on the head.
Not even close. Oh no.
I was going to say close. It's so funny because, well, the nun, that's interesting that religion does come into play with the story that we'll talk about a little further in the interview about Uncle Nearest, but I actually sell liquor.
Okay. Well, can you tell our listeners a little bit about you then, Kitty?
So I am, my real name is Kirsten. I go by Kitty. That's my nickname. We can talk about that too. That was given to me when I was like a baby waitress by one of my managers that like couldn't be bothered to learn how to pronounce my name. And I am the Boston area, well, actually Massachusetts and New Hampshire brand ambassador for a whiskey company called Uncle Nearest Whiskey. And that's where I do, it's kind of a blend of sales and marketing, and that's what I do for my full-time job. I'm also a kind of cocktail historian and a cocktail book author and writer. And soon, well, recent podcaster. I don't have many years under my belt like you guys.
You will do fine when it comes to podcasting, because look at us. We literally just wake up, look at Bell. He's
still waking up.
He's just like that. And, you know, we just record. But I have one question for you. You say you're a historian.
Cocktail historian. Yeah.
So explain that to everybody here. Like, yeah, when you talk about a cocktail historian, how far back can you?
Yeah. Talk about? Oh, you can go way back to the beginning of distilling, which would have been done in like Egypt. That's where they figured out distilling. That's a great question because it explains kind of how I got into the whiskey side. So when I first started working in restaurants, I did it for the money. And I was a really bad waitress at first. And so I decided I wanted to be a really good waitress. And I became like a really good waitress. And that was awesome. And then I also learned how to bartend. But all of that was like, early, you know, 2000s. And a few years after I started working in restaurants, the cocktail resurgence started to happen in a big way in Boston. And so I started to learn. I've been working in restaurants since I could work. It was, you know, 16 years old, my first job kind of thing. But I started to understand, like, I had been selling these products like whiskey. Like, I didn't know the differences between bourbon and scotch. And I didn't know, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I was just serving these people these things. And then I started to learn that there was this whole rich history of what people drink, just like what people eat. And so I kind of really got drawn into learning about cocktail history from there. So truly, it's been really fun and fascinating because I'm a big history nerd, too. And
I thought for a second you were going to say, well, I got really drunk and then I just learned the history.
It's a hands-on class. It's a hands-on class. Yeah.
It's a trial and error class, right?
Yeah.
That's so
cool. Well, it is true.
So when you were like being a waitress, what were some like horror stories that you got? Because I know everybody who's worked in the food industry.
Oh my God.
Including myself has had some horror stories.
You got anything on top of your head? Jeez, some of them are really inappropriate, I feel like.
Even better.
This is even better. sounds perfect for Belle's street here.
I love it. There was one time, so I worked in a neighborhood in Boston called the South End. I don't know if you were there when you visited last, or if it rings a bell. Mm-hmm. So there's South End and there's Southie. So Southie is like Goodwill Hunting and The Departed. Everybody knows Southie. South End is across the river. It's kind of like a little bit of a bigger neighborhood than Beacon Hill. So it's a very historic, really pretty neighborhood. And when I first moved there, it was mostly like the gay. It was known for being like the gay neighborhood. And so Pride was always crazy, right? there was one shift where I think we had just opened for like a Saturday brunch and they only had like me and my co-author working. And I just remember like getting so busy when all these people came over at the Pride Parade. Just as we were getting busy, someone's dog puked on the patio. It was horrible. And we, you know, we just got like, we got totally annihilated. And then the next day I remember working and I had a customer who was like, I took his order and he was like, snapped at me like, hurry it up, like make sure it's quick because I haven't eaten in 3 days. I was like, oh my God.
What the?
And only now, like I'm 22 at the time, right? And so, but like years later, I'm like, oh my God, like maybe he didn't eat for 3 days and he just partied. Like,
that's exactly.
And I was that annoying 22-year-old like waitress. I couldn't get him the food fast enough. So that was hard. I don't think he was trying to meet me.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
Oh my God.
So as far as, I guess, cocktail historian, is there one specific cocktail that stands out as far as a rich history for you?
Yeah, actually, I usually like to. So my friends and I, looping back to like how I got into this, like in 2007, my friend Misty, who is my co-author, Misty Kalkofen, Misty and Kitty, those are our real names. That's usually what I have to say to people when they meet us. and she started a group here. She had discovered a club called LUPEC through the magic of the internet. And that stood for Ladies United for the Preservation of Endangered Cocktails. And so we started a Boston chapter. And it was a blend of consumers and bartenders. Or not consumers. Consumers is such a salesy word. But it was a blend of like people who had like different kind of day walker day jobs. And then myself and people who were working in the industry. And so part of that was so much fun. It was mostly like just a cocktail club, like a monthly bar hang at a bar, hang at someone's house. And we would research cocktails and come up with a theme. And that's kind of where this all started going for me. And we also did fundraising. So we did some pretty big events and we raised like $40,000 for some local women's charities over the years, which was really cool. But the drink, part of it was the very first meeting we had, we each chose a cocktail name. And the cocktail name that I chose was the Pink Lady, which is very, very cool. So I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that cocktail or tried it.
I've heard of Pink Lady before, but I've never tried it though.
Yeah, so there's two recipes. There's one that was popular in the 50s. It's made with like grenadine and like cream, which I actually never had. But the original recipe, from what we know, is a recipe that's from like 1919 or maybe earlier, maybe 1910. But it's a drink that's made with gin, which at the time, 2007, like nobody was really drinking and I didn't really drink. I mean, people drink it, but it's not like a gin craze like it is now, seriously. And then it also has Applejack, which is America's first distilled spirit, which is a spirit that's made from apples. It's not like the cereal and it's not like pucker.
Oh, it's not the cereal. Sorry, I'm out there.
Yeah, yeah. So it's got a double base, which I think is interesting. And I didn't know you could make cocktails really that way then. It also has grenadine, which if you guys have ever made grenadine before, you know, at the time, 2007, mostly you'd see like roses or something like that. So something that's going to be like pretty sweet and has food dye coloring and stuff like that. But if you make your own, it's just pomegranate simple syrup. Mm. So good. So fresh. The drink also has a lemon and then it also has egg white in it, which was like something that blew my mind. So 2007, I was like, wow, what are these crazy kids doing with egg white?
Got to be a little bit healthy with it, right?
Yeah, so that's kind of like a, I like that drink as like a vegetable cocktail because I think people are usually interested to know. I didn't know, but back pre-prohibition, egg white was a common drink modifier. Pre-prohibition, people were making all of their things. They didn't just have roses and stuff like that. So there's lots of cool kind of like historical reference for that. The drink itself actually takes the name from a play that was super popular on Broadway, which was very, very common to kind of like naming your drinks after movies now, right?
Right, exactly. I think the most interesting part, right, like that you mentioned was like how distilled was kind of created in like Egypt, like, but you just don't see anything from there that like you, that's popular, right? Like
it's fascinating.
Yeah, like that's just crazy how things have moved all over the world when a place like that is originated. Not many people knew that. I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Well, it also, it's something that we like, and this is something that's really interesting, is that a lot of times when I've learned about spirits and stuff like that, we talk about it from like Irish learning the art of distillation in 11th century, I think is when they're, is that right? But the history is so much richer, right? And it stretches way further back to like ancient civilizations and things of that nature. So it's like, it's just really, really cool. And some of the research that I've done really seems to indicate that women were early distillers because distillation was like viewed as similar to cooking. So they would have access to the utensils to do cooking and they would know. And these women became like the early chemists, right? So that's like super, super cool too, because that's a science, is a field that women have often. I learned this a lot when I was working on the book with my friend Misty. We celebrated stories of unsung women from history, and we were just like, wow, this is amazing, because there's a lot of cases in science where they take the women out of the story, steal the patent, put the man's name on, you know, this kind of thing. So it's very cool to think about it being women who are starting distillation, right?
So have you tried this recipe on Uncle Nearest's website, the tuxedo, because I was reading about it and it's dripped, like it's whiskey's dripped, just like coffee's dripped in there. How does that, like,
I didn't know. That drink. It's a beautiful, beautiful cocktail. That's the one from the San Francisco bartender, I think, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think actually when I was reading that recipe, I was like, this is so incredible. But I think that that's a real, like, super, super talented mixologist who's making those drinks there, because all of the drinks that I've seen that he's made before are like super composed and like really interesting. So I'm not that kind of mixologist.
but do you know how dripping the whiskey like benefits in that? Like, what does it do to it? Is it just like the making of it, or does it change it in any way?
Just, I need to take a look at the recipe actually to refresh. So creative, right? Like, just incredible. These things that people think of with cocktails. It's so artful and delicious. Something that's really brilliant about that too is that, like, one of the main, if you're doing a whiskey tasting, like, you know, coffee is a flavor compound that's pretty common in whiskeys. You know, so it's a flavor that, like, I know I pick up on when I taste whiskey. So he's probably kind of joining. Sometimes when you're making a drink, you like join with a flavor that's already there and like amplify it or whatever. So it's a very cool way to think about making up drinks.
I've seen a lot of like espressos fused with alcohol now. Like, it seems like that's like the norm way to go, right?
Yeah, which Jameson has like a coffee, iced coffee Jameson.
Yeah, Jameson does
something like that. That'd be sick, an iced coffee.
But it's like, just it's like iced coffee with whiskey in it, right?
It's so weird how it's evolved to this now.
It's amazing.
Now you can just have it for breakfast, which is best of both worlds. Right
there, right? Actually, so to your point about that, the cocktails made with eggs were often breakfast drinks.
Really?
So in the U.S., I don't know as much about Canadian cocktail history, but in U.S., the people were drinking very, very, very vast amounts of alcohol in the whole history of our country, certainly around the revolutionary times. Because what they would do then was, like, they would go to the pub and then they would drink from the punch bowl, and you would drink until the punch bowl was gone. It's a punch bowl. It's huge. Like, what if it's just the four of us, right?
We'd finish it.
We sure would. But during like the saloon era, like really people were drinking, you know, you'd go in for a drink any time of the day, I think. And so an egg cocktail was something that was considered like good for helping with your, if you have a little fog from the night before.
Really? Is it that's good for like recoveries? I didn't know that.
I think the only way to help to really not have a hangover is to not have a drink, truthfully. But there's some really throughout time, hangover repudiated recipes are so funny. And I think that's one of them, is that people thought it would really, it probably just got you nice and buzzed, so you weren't thinking about your hangover anymore.
Wait, Nick, you're saying it doesn't, like, anytime I've been crazy hungover, like vacation or something or whatever, if you have a beer, or any drink, it, honestly, it just erases the hangover. I don't know about you guys.
I think we touched on it earlier. I think when you have another drink, the fact is you're just keeping that buzz going. I don't know if you're necessarily recovering from a hangover.
I don't know.
I just sleep. That's it, man. That's my recovery. Just sleep. I just forget what time it is and just sleep. Yeah. I can't handle like I used to anymore. So sleep is key. But moving forward here, when like the book, where can anybody reach and find that book that you got?
Thank you for asking. So the book, so it's called Drinking Like Ladies, and the subtitle is 75. Oh my gosh, I forgot the subtitle. It's 75 Modern Cocktails from the World's Best Female Bartenders, I think is what they ended up saying for us. But anyway, it's 75 cocktails, and we have women from all over the world who basically we chose, and this is why I was so excited to learn about Uncle Nearest, because I had spent, you know, several years working on, actually many, many years working on this book because it was rejected for many, many years. It was a 10-year-long labor of love that book was circulating around to different publishers. Wow. Getting told no. We researched 75 unsung women. Some are famous, like women that you're going to know about, like, and some are not, that I had never heard of. And then we sent bio information on those women to the contributing bartenders, who were all working women. And they created cocktails in honor of the person. And it's just the drinks, so many of the drinks are just so incredibly creative. Like, they really run the gamut from like more, I like usually make a more simple cocktail. Like you were saying, I'll put like fruit in my simple syrup and things like that. Like I'm a little bit lazy sometimes when it comes to cocktails, so I might level up there, you know? But some of these women, like one girl made a drink with baked potato peel syrup. Just insane. I know. I don't know how she got there.
Potato skin cocktail.
The drink
cocktail
is real good. What's that?
A potato skin cocktail.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually a rum drink and it has cream in it. So it ends up being like sweet. It just tastes, it's delicious. Like it tastes like a sweet and like a dessert-y kind of super balanced. It's really creative.
Sounds like my alley. That's the book. Sweet and rum. I enjoy that.
Yeah. It's awesome. So, but the book actually is available for purchase on Amazon, or probably, I'm not sure any specific stores in Canada that have it. But you should be able to get it online. That helps us. That helps the publisher know that we sold books. and then if I'm ever nearby, my friend Misty, my co-author and I, Misty, if we're ever selling books at events, one thing that we do is we donate all of the proceeds that we make from those book sales to women's charities in the area. So
that's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's still it's really important to us. I'll never, we'll see, maybe someday I'll be somehow uber wealthy, but we started all of this Loopback the Book Everything with the idea that we're probably never going to be able to just donate like a wing to something, you know. So we'll do the best that we can with resources that we have to, you know, try to do good for.
Nice.
Yeah.
So how, I was wondering, because for in Boston, like I was there as well. Nick was there. You were there last year, Nick?
You were there in January.
Yeah, I was there last year in the summer. So I loved it. Like, it honestly, it's one of my favorite cities so far. And like the beer scene is amazing there. How would you rank like the cocktail and connoisseur scene kind of, just because like, if I had to guess, you would probably rank it pretty high, but like, is it somewhere, cause I don't know. It just seems cultured in Boston. Like it seems like they would know about cocktails and whatnot, but is that like where in the US is kind of the hotspot for that? And where does Boston rank with that?
That's a great question. So New York, Chicago, LA, New York. Oh, I don't know if I should say anything now, because what if people from LA get mad at me if I take them out? but I would say New York and Chicago are usually mentioned in the same sentences, and Boston as well. But it's just a much smaller scene. Like, we're just such a much, much smaller city. San Francisco also has incredible cocktail culture. The thing about Boston that's interesting is that while this was all like taking off and people were, I mean, really, like when the cocktail resurgence was starting to happen, in the States at least, it was like some pretty nerdy bartenders that were like finding old cocktail books and getting really into them. Like, it wasn't really like as kind of glamorous as it is a little bit more now, or it has been at least before COVID, you know what I mean? It was enthusiasts and nerds. And so, and they created like beautiful concepts for bars and restaurants from that, which is incredible. But like in Boston, like you can't, like no one could ever get, it's too small. Like you can't ever get too like big for your britches here. Like, you know, there are certainly, as cocktails started to get more and more popular, like, you know, there is sort of the stereotype of the bartender who gets super egotistical and like, you know, doesn't want to serve. There was a phase, I don't know if any of you were drinking out and about then, or if anyone has ever, you know, there were phases where, you know, certain bars wouldn't serve you like a vodka drink. Like they just didn't have it. Like I actually know a bartender that explained to me once what he does. And you can't do that in a city like Boston. Like, you can't be like, I think your drink is stupid and you can't have it. Like you have to drink my cocktail that I invented, you know, because first of all, screw you. Like,
It's kind of like a DJ, right? It's like, hey, you guys are not going to play. We're not going to play anything else. We're just going to play like my mixes.
DJs get upset at that now. Like, I was at a reception and I was asking a DJ. First of all, the DJ is all the way in the back behind like these prison bars. Like, it was weird. And I'm asking him, hey, play this, and he just got upset. He's like, no, we don't. We only play what we have, because they think that you know more than that in terms of what you should play at this moment. They think that you're going again, which I get. It's kind of their art. Same goes for the bartender, but you know, for the average person partying there or drinking at the bar, it's hard for them to understand, right?
Big time. And then, you know, to kind of follow along with that, like there's, I don't know if you guys have been to any like speakeasies, but there were in New York, some really famous ones. And I always thought that was so interesting because there's another bar that comes to mind, which is really incredible, but you know, they don't let you stand. Right. And so it's this weird thing of like, I think it became popular in New York because it was like, every place is always so busy. It's like a super big crush, like to get in anywhere. Like you don't get to, you know what I mean? And that's so frustrating. So, you know, these places create Milk and Honey was the first one, and that was in New York. And you know, you'd have to, there was no website. You'd have to get a phone number. You'd have to call the phone number to make a reservation. You technically didn't know where it was. Like, there was no listing for the address, but like, obviously if you went there once, you knew where it was, because like, it didn't change locations.
Just keeps moving it underground. Yeah, New York.
I know, one day, right? To Brooklyn. You could totally see someone do that, but you can't. My point with all of that is that like, you can't really do that in Boston. Like, if you tell people you can't come to their bar, they're not going to come. Whereas in some cities, it's like, if you tell me, I'm like that. Like, if you tell me I can't come, I'm going to want to come to your bar. I like, you know, so that works on me, but like, as a model in the city of Boston, like, you can't really do that. So we're a little bit, we're smaller, and I think hospitality has to be part of it. Like, you can't, you know, like the people who work in the great cocktail bars in Boston and work in the industry really value, and are hyper into like hospitality and always making sure.
So New York's pretty much rude is what you're saying.
I mean, the whole East Coast, really. The whole Northeast. Bostonians are pretty rude. I've noticed this when I've traveled to Canada, actually. I've been to Toronto and Montreal. I haven't yet been to your area, which we talked about. But you notice when, or also my company, Uncle Nearest, is based in the South. So, you know, I get down there and I'm like, wow, you people are so much nicer than the people in Boston. You know, like, they'll like super politely, like, you know, say hi to you in the airport and you're like, why are you talking to me? Oh, no. Yeah.
It's so funny because like, I remember when I was at the airport in Boston and I was just getting a drink and I just said, thank you. And the person just kept on saying, sure. I was like, oh yeah, thanks. Sure. I was like, what do you mean sure? Like, what is sure? Like, I was just so baffled by it, but then I just realized, wow, I'm literally like so Canadian. I can't believe it. Like, it's just when you go somewhere else, your Canadian genes just kick in and you just become that stereotype. It's just, oh, it's so weird.
Yeah, manners. Manners.
Cool. Like, your manners just make you stick right out in Boston.
Oh, it's crazy. So it was so crazy. All I remember was sure. And I was getting so upset at this. I was like, why do you even like say, yeah, like, thank you and stuff, like, anyways.
That's weird. That's really funny.
So.